From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tighe. Today on the show, we start a series on the promise and reality of green energy in Wisconsin. Today, an overview of green energy here. Then an argument that the greening of the grid is best left to the free market.
Whether we recognize it or not, market forces have been the primary driver in the improvements that we've seen in sustainability.
Later, a new documentary focuses on the world of early American circuses. And Milwaukee writer Dean Jensen's new book spotlights the rise and fall of two circus superstars.
It's almost like a modern Greek tragedy, I think, because in tragedy, by definition, the players put their own ends into motion.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you for being with us today. We start our latest Project Milwaukee series today called Power Switch. Over the next 5 days, Lake Effect and the WUWM News Department are taking a comprehensive look at the promise and reality of green energy in Wisconsin. From solar power to wind energy to biomass, natural gas, and more, sustainable energy is in the Wisconsin portfolio. But how large a slice of the pie does it represent? Where does Wisconsin fall in a national context? And what are the factors that will determine what the future of green energy looks like in this state? We'll look at all of those questions this week. Helping us with an overview this morning is George Stone. He's a natural sciences instructor at Milwaukee Area Technical College, a regular Lake Effect contributor, and most importantly for this series, the organizer of the annual Sustainability Summit in Milwaukee. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Mitch. It's great to be here, as always.
Well, let me start with the biggest of questions for you. We talk a lot about green energy. It's a term that gets used a lot, but I'm not sure everybody necessarily has the same definition for it. So when you hear the term green energy or you use that term, what's your working definition of what it actually represents?
2 years ago, maybe it was three years ago, we changed the name of our annual conference from the Renewable Energy Summit to the Green Energy Summit. And we stayed with that name for 2 years. And then this past year, we changed it further to Sustainability Summit. And these name changes really reflected a broadening of the scope of this conference. Renewable energy, I think most people have a grasp that that refers to wind energy and solar energy and bioenergy principally and geothermal energy. These are the principal sources of renewable energy. We expanded that title to Green Energy Summit in order to reflect the increased emphasis on energy efficiency. About 40% of all energy is used in buildings, and about 20% of that, or about half of that, or 20% of the total, can be fairly easily saved just by improving insulation, better lighting, better windows, and changes of that sort, low-hanging fruit, as it's often called. And more and more emphasis was being placed. Plus, we have a couple of programs here in the city of Milwaukee, ME2 for residences and ME3 for businesses being administered by the city of Milwaukee through grants, I think, from the Federal Department of Energy. And so increased emphasis on energy efficiency added to renewable energy. That equation came out to equal green energy. So I think it was in order to encompass that broader scope. And, of course, another aspect of that is the best way to save energy is not to use it at all. To me, green energy encompasses energy conservation, energy efficiency, and renewable energy.
How much more can conservation accomplish? Where are we in terms of that being part of the low-hanging fruit? How much more difference can our own habits in terms of using energy, in an environment where there are more people than ever, how much more difference can conservation make?
I think it can make a very significant difference. We have a rather wasteful culture, a wasteful economy, the throwaway economy, if you will, where a lot of products have been made not to last very long and then to be replaced by a new purchase. Whether it is turning down the thermostat in the wintertime or turning it up in summertime and using less energy for heating and cooling, that's energy conservation. Walking instead of driving, or riding a bicycle instead of driving your car. This conserves the fuel energy that you would otherwise use. And we just have compared to the rest of the world and the number of calories outside of our own bodies that we burn in the ordinary exercise of daily activities is really extreme compared to much of the world. And so clearly we can save a lot of energy by conserving, by changing our lifestyles. Now, the trouble is that our whole economic model is based on growth and economic development and economic growth. But we have a small planet with limited resources. I love the old quote from Kenneth Boulding, a famous economist, who said the only people who think you can have unlimited economic growth on a planet or with a resource base that is limited or finite are either madmen or mad women or economists. You know, and so sooner or later, we're going to have to modify our model of unlimited economic growth. And that's the wasteful model. And I suppose the marketplace will control this as commodities become more expensive and resources become more expensive. But there should be an aesthetic, an ethical, a moral aspect to this, too. I often say and tell my students, all human endeavor, all human enterprise has a moral dimension. And we need to be more conscious of that. And what does that mean? That means responsibility to future generations.
Over the next few days, we are going to hear from people in various aspects of this field talking about a variety of programs that are either working or not working or down the road or in the past. Can you give us a snapshot of where you think Wisconsin is in the green energy movement? I'll stop the question there. Where are we compared to where the rest of the country is, and where is this country compared to where the rest of the world is?
Well, the country is not far enough along the road, as far as it should be, because we're really still subsidizing the traditional fossil fuels as energy sources. The oil companies, for example, and the gas companies get tax write-offs for exploring for new oil and gas deposits. Well, why should companies, which are making tens of billion dollars a year profit, why should the taxpayers be subsidizing their expenses? I mean, it's because they have such a powerful lobby. I won't go so far as to say they own our government, but they certainly have an extraordinary influence. And we also are not subsidizing the competition, if you want to call it that, which would be renewable energy sources. Now, in Germany, for example, they started subsidizing photovoltaics or solar electricity a quarter of a century ago, and Germany gradually built up their technology and their production, and they soon were leading the world. They were overtaken a couple of years ago by China simply because of the size of that country. But we're way behind on that. We've got a wonderful company right here in the Menominee Valley, Helios USA, which manufactures solar panels, and they're having a tough time competing. And another aspect to that, of course, is that the Chinese are flooding the market and trying to drive the other people out of business. But if we subsidized renewable energy instead of the fossil fuel companies that are making huge profits, then that would help our industries in the international marketplace. And that's what's needed. And sooner or later, the transition away from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources is going to accelerate. It already is worldwide, and it will in this country as well. And the more investment that we have in that and the farther along our technology is, the better we're going to be able to compete. So it's in our own self-interest. Now, one aspect in Wisconsin is that we have no fossil fuels here. We have no coal, petroleum, or natural gas. And the estimates vary anywhere from $12 to $18 billion as to how much money we spend each year that flows out of Wisconsin in order to either import the fossil fuels themselves or to import the energy from them. That's a huge amount of money. If we invested more in clean technology, clean energy, and green energy in the state of Wisconsin, then that would not only create more jobs, which we sorely need, but it would also keep that money in the state and help the economic development. This is one sector in which Wisconsin can undergo a significant amount of growth. And the recent report issued by the Wisconsin Energy Institute under the leadership or directorship of Gary Radloff indicated very clearly that we are back in the middle of the pack. We're trailing far behind where we ought to be in the development of renewable energy. And one area where we have a leg up is in biomass and such things as cow manure.
Digesters.
Extracting methane from organic waste. And we have a lot of food processing. That's a big industry in this state. And there's a lot of organic waste there, too, from which we could extract a methane or natural gas. And this is not fossil natural gas. This is recycled. So a lot of potential there. We're not doing as much as we should.
There was a flurry of interest in fields like solar and geothermal in the 1970s, energy shortage days. It ebbed somewhat with the advent of more fuel-efficient cars. How do you think the market pressures in those days compare to what the power industry sees today?
Well, the principal driver of that, the trigger of that movement was the OPEC oil embargo in 1973, when the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, cut off the supply. And suddenly there were gas lines blocks or even miles long. There was a shortage of energy. We realized that we were excessively dependent on overseas energy. And the whole movement, and this was on the heels of environmental awareness and the environmental movement in the 70s anyway. And matter of fact, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act had just been signed into law about that same time. So the combination of increased environmental awareness and the OPEC oil embargo did lead to a flurry of activity and attention to renewable energy back in the 70s. And Jimmy Carter was sympathetic to that. He understood the problem. He understood the challenges and the opportunities. And he even installed photovoltaic cells, if you remember, on the White House. And people made fun of him for being too extreme. But that soon died out with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1981. And throughout the 80s, the PV system at the White House was removed. And that was symbolic of the change in emphasis in the country. Now, more recently, I would say, following on the heels of James Hansen's testimony before Congress in 1988, in the summer of 1988, warning the country and the world about the impending threats from global warming due to excessive combustion of fossil fuels and addition of carbon dioxide to the planet's atmosphere, the movement for transition away from fossil fuels, for reduced dependence on fossil fuels, began anew, but from a different perspective, for different reasons. It's very slow, and of course, the status quo is cherished by the fossil fuel companies. They don't want to see change. And so we really haven't made much progress. And that's true of the nation and of the state of Wisconsin. Many parts of the rest of the world, the Europeans have done much more. But there's a great deal more that remains to be done. And as you know, the amount of carbon dioxide accumulating in the atmosphere is increasing all the time. We've just reached about 400 parts per million, a real red flag, a landmark value. So we need to refocus our attention.
Is there still work to be done to make sure that this meets everyone? I mean, it's one thing to talk about putting solar panels on a house or otherwise retrofitting as things to run in a more green fashion. There are thousands of homes and apartment buildings inhabited in this city by people who have difficulty putting food on the table, let alone, you know, erecting a wind turbine in their backyards. How does this phenomenon meet everyone?
Well, wind turbines really are more appropriate for rural areas because they do require a lot of space and they're not appropriate for the city. But solar panels are. And we do have a wonderful program here in Milwaukee called Milwaukee Shines. The Federal Department of Energy designated Milwaukee as a solar city, one of, I think, just over 100 or so in the country. Madison, we have two in Wisconsin, Milwaukee and Madison. And the Milwaukee Shines program, administered by the city of Milwaukee under Matt Howard and Amy Hart, this is an excellent program which has provides opportunities and assistance for residential citizens in Milwaukee to install solar panels. So the possibility is there. Unfortunately, the emphasis at the state level, Focus on Energy, which is a state agency funded by the ratepayer surcharge on our utility bills, the emphasis there has kind of drifted away from wind and solar. The emphasis, as determined by the Public Service Commission, is more on bioenergy in the renewable field. But we need to, at every level, the city of Milwaukee certainly is providing leadership and is eager to do more, but it's doing it with federal funds. We need more emphasis on conserving energy, on renewable energy at the state level.
George Stone, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure as always, Mitch. Thank you.
George Stone teaches natural sciences at MATC and is the organizer of the annual Sustainability Summit. The 2014 edition is scheduled for next March at what is currently known as the Delta Center in downtown Milwaukee. Our Project Milwaukee Power Switch series continues after a break with a policy expert who believes that market forces are the best determinant of what green energy sources will thrive down the road. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, Lake Effect contributor George Stone talked about the state of green energy in Wisconsin and what he sees as its potential. It's a question that's being asked on a national scale, especially in the wake of some highly publicized missteps, such as the failure of the company Solyndra, which had significant funding from federal sources. Recently, the Wall Street Journal asked several experts in the field the question, what renewable energy source has the most promise? The answers ranged from natural gas to solar to a mix. But another view was expressed by Todd Myers. His take was that the answer should be driven by whatever the market dictates. Myers is the environmental director at the Washington Policy Center, a free market think tank in Seattle, and he's on the line with us now. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Why would you contend that market forces rather than policy would best dictate the future of green energy?
Well, what we see, I think, actually is that whether we recognize it or not, market forces have been the primary driver in the improvements that we've seen in sustainability. Politics and politicians are very good at taking credit, but they aren't very good at creating the direction. And the best example, I think, is one that people see every day, which is the Toyota Prius. The Toyota Prius is practically the symbol of environmental concern and environmental responsibility, and yet it didn't come from government ideas, government programs. It came from the free market. In fact, California's laws requiring zero-emission vehicles actually discriminated against hybrid vehicles in the early years, and it wasn't until about 2003 that politicians decided to jump on the bandwagon and start supporting hybrids. But Toyota and Honda saw an opportunity to sell cars to people who cared about the environment, wanted to use less fuel and impact the environment less, and so they created the hybrid, which was the best technology at the time. And it has become, you know, like I said, the symbol of environmental consciousness. That's what the free market does, and it's all around us. We don't always see it, though.
Well, what would you say the tipping point is? Why haven't market forces made green energy a bigger piece of the pie at this point?
Well, because I think that there are other things that are more useful. I think when you focus just on green energy, you become myopic and you lose sight of what's going on around you. In the last 30 years, the United States has cut the amount of energy per unit of GDP in half. And so while solar is still very inefficient and wind is more and certainly more efficient but still less efficient than other forms of energy, conservation, more efficient equipment and technology, things that do more with less, which is what the free market is great at creating, are where the real innovations have come from. So if you only, you know, narrow your focus to solar and wind, then you say, well, gee, this isn't moving very rapidly. But if you look at all of the millions of things that people do in their day-to-day lives and that we're encouraged to do because it costs us money if we don't economize, then you're missing the vast majority of what's going on. And I think that's the real problem with politicians, is that they focus on the very sexy things that can be sold in public, but not the things that work.
There are a number of people who, in reporting for this series, have said that, you know, when you're talking about green energy, the ultimate green energy is just using less.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's old Ben Franklin, right? A penny saved is a penny earned. And so if you don't have to use that energy, then that's probably even better than solar or wind, because you still have to manufacture the solar panels, you still have to manufacture the wind turbines. But if you don't use the energy in the first place, you're doing better. And the same thing is true in transportation. I think one of the greatest green transportation approaches is going to be telecommuting, right? As we get more bandwidth, more people can telecommute to work. You do that, you cut, you know, one day a week, you cut your energy use by 20% just by doing that, which would be a huge reduction in the amount of fuel that people use. So those are the sorts of technologies that we need to be thinking about, not just narrowly focused on a few things.
Do you see policymakers as having any role in driving the technology discussion?
There's no question that a lot of these things, that CO2 emissions are not captured in my cost, right? Right now I can drive down the street and the CO2 and the other things that go into the air and impact other people I'm not paying for. So I do think that policymakers have a role to play in leveling that playing field and making it so that I have to pay the costs for the impact. I mean, this is something that actually I think, you know, conservatives and liberals agree on. You know, conservatives are very strong in the belief that if you cause damage to somebody else through crime, well, then you have to pay the price for that. And the same thing is true if you pour, you know, sewage into the water or put CO2 in the air that has an impact, you have to pay for that. And the way that we do that, and often the best way to do that, is to create a simple regulation or a simple price for that impact. The problem is that we get seduced by picking and choosing technologies or trying to figure out the way to solve those problems. And as I said, there's a million little ways that add up to more than the few big ways that politicians tend to focus on.
One could make the point, in fact, some have made the point, that government has always been involved at some level in picking winners or losers, whether it's, you know, in terms of providing tax credits for green technology companies these days, or making it easier for conventional power producers or oil and gas companies to do their jobs in the past.
Well, that's just an argument that says it happened, not that it's a good thing. And the example that I will give is corn-based ethanol. We spent a heck of a lot of money promoting corn-based ethanol, which we now agree probably is not even good in terms of CO2 reduction. It also is more polluting in terms of traditional air pollution. And frankly, as I'm a beekeeper, and corn is horrible for bees. And if we're worried about bee collapse, the expansion of cornfields in the Midwest is one thing that people say is causing more stress on bees, along with some other things. So we've recognized now that the corn-based ethanol strategy has been really a poor one environmentally, and yet we did it. So just arguing that we have done things in the past doesn't mean that they're good or that we ought to do them in the future.
In your piece in the Wall Street Journal recently, you write that it would be wise to reduce the costs of taking risks in the process of discovering new technologies. How might that happen?
Well, there's a variety of things. In Washington State, for instance, where I am, we have a tax law that makes it very hard for startups, puts huge tax burdens on them. There have also been tax incentives for innovation, capital investment tax credits, those sorts of things, that have encouraged people to take risks today, to spend the upfront money to become more efficient today. Normally those things would take, you know, a long time to pay off, but if you give them incentives to do that, they can invest today. The other thing, though, is if you do put a price on carbon, the simple economics of efficiency change. What might not have paid off for 10 years now pays off in 7 or 8 and looks better. So I'm not a fan of getting too far down the road of incentivizing one thing or another, but I think if you do want to incentivize, either put a price on carbon or incentivize innovation, you do so with a very broad-based approach rather than saying these green energies are the ones that we want to promote. That tends not to work.
Todd Myers, they're all really interesting points and ones I'm glad you made for us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Todd Myers is the environmental director at the Washington Policy Center, a free market think tank in Seattle. You'll find a link to his recent contribution to a Wall Street Journal feature on renewable energy at wuwm.com/likeeffect. And for something completely different, we turn our attention to the circus circa the early 20th century when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Of all the states, perhaps Wisconsin has among the greatest connections to the history of the American circus movement. It was home to the Ringling Brothers, whose circus merged with those of P.T. Barnum and James A. Bailey. And since 1959, it's been home to Circus World, now the Circus World Museum, on the grounds of the former winter home to the Ringling Brothers Circus in Baraboo. A new film by Iowa native Gene Gamache tells the story of the early history of American circuses and of Charles Chappie Fox, the man who single-handedly rescued hundreds of antique circus wagons and restored them at Circus World. The film is called A Circus Life, and Gamache tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North how he came to make it.
I was actually making another documentary in Wisconsin, in Appleton, doing a documentary on Houdini, and was introduced, my co-producer and co-director on A Circus Life, Kirk Carter. Actually, the two of us were introduced to Chappie Fox by a man named Tom Bolt. Tom actually took us to the circus parade in Milwaukee and kind of got us hooked on this amazing visual event and parade. And we ended up deciding to do the documentary and had some amazing interviews with Chappie Fox. And actually, the first interview was 4 hours long, and he didn't bat an eye. I mean, he was under hot lights. We were actually getting tired and hot, and he just kept going. And it was amazing, the stories he was telling us about the circus and his involvement with collecting these circus wagons.
And the other thing that was so interesting is that this was really a second career for him. It was a passion of his all his life, but being able to do this kind of restoration came to him somewhat late in life.
Yeah, he actually said to us that if he could do it again, he'd live the last 25 years over and over again, because that was his favorite time and the time when he was really involved with the Circus World Museum and collecting these circus wagons and also working tirelessly to have the parade every year.
Now, for you as a filmmaker, how did you first think about putting this on the screen? Because it's a big story. I mean, the first part of the film really kind of talks about the history of the circus in the United States and then kind of goes into the circus wagons. But did you start out thinking that's how you wanted to approach it?
Interestingly, the film was actually originally two parts. And the first part talked about the early American circus and the circus parades and how the wagons were used. And we actually interviewed a couple circus performers, a man by the name of Al Mann and also his wife, Irene. And they told us a little bit what it was like to be on a circus in those days and also a little bit about the circus parades. And then other circus historians talking about the early American circus. And that led up until the demise of the circus parade and kind of the transformation of the circus. And then part two was sort of Chappie getting more involved with the collecting of the wagons and realizing that there was this amazing piece of history out there laying in farm fields, rotting away. And he just felt he needed to rescue those wagons and make them part of the Circus World Museum's collection, because no other museum had that type of collection. It was kind of a two-part documentary that just recently I put the two parts together and created a feature, 88-minute feature-length film.
Yeah, and I think it flows together really nicely because it takes you from that larger overview of what the circus was and why it was so important in American culture, and then taking it down to the more detailed of literally watching artisans recreate and reproduce parts for these wagons because, they, as you say, they had rotted away.
Absolutely, and the thing is, you know, Chappie even says in the film that if they'd started the museum 10 years later, most of these wagons would have been burned up and lost. So the timing was critical. And I think right now they have over 200 wagons in the museum collection in Baraboo. And that collection represents maybe 2/3 of the remaining wagons on the planet that were used by circuses. So, and also the interesting thing to me is these wagons have survived. And, you know, the owners, the circus owners are no longer here who created the wagons, who had them built. The artisans who originally carved and made the wagons are no longer here. But here these wagons have lasted, you know, over 100 years and they're still with us. It's really amazing. And, you know, they've been on every just about every street in America.
This collection here in Wisconsin is about two-thirds of what's extant. And that's only about, what, 3% of what was actually produced and used during the heyday?
Exactly. And it's interesting, but, you know, the circus owners considered these wagons, they were just sort of tools that they used to promote the circus. And once they could no longer use the wagons because the cities changed and they couldn't drive the parade down the middle of Main Street because of cars and streetlights, they ended up becoming junk to the circus owners, and they just trashed them. They threw them off the sides of trains and just discarded them. So that's why they laid in these farm fields for so many years before Chappie and some of these other folks at the Circus World Museum discovered them.
So now, is the restoration still going on? I mean, I know he died about 10 years ago, right?
Yes, that's correct. And they still are restoring wagons. The Circus World Museum is still going strong and actually a wonderful place to visit. You can take the family and see a lot of history there. And you can actually walk through the wagon pavilion right up close to these wagons and see the amazing carvings and the beautiful colors. And it's really educational. They also have performances during the summer months up there in Baraboo at the Circus World Museum grounds.
As you were doing the research for this film and also putting the film together, I mean, did it surprise you that circuses were so important when they were in their heyday?
Actually, yes, it did. And the thing that amazed me the most was, you know, I work in movie advertising. That's what I do for a living and edit movie trailers. And actually, the circus parade was how the circus actually promoted the circus. It was their trailer. And when they would arrive in town and with all these horses pulling these wagons with, you know, musicians and bands on top of the wagons, they'd create quite a ruckus in town. And that became their arrival and their announcement to the town that the circus is here, follow the parade, and you can see us set up the tent and then later watch the performance. So that was something I really didn't know. You know, I went to the circus when I was a kid, but I didn't realize that's kind of how it got its start. And also, the educational aspect. I had no idea that back then they didn't have the internet, they didn't really have much photography. And so the first chance people ever got to see a lion or an elephant or any of these exotic performers was actually in the circus. And so it wasn't just entertainment, it was also educational.
What about some of the archival footage that you used here? How did you track some of that down? It was amazing to see, particularly when you talked about Al Mann and his wife, and there was some footage there, not just still photographs, but actual moving footage of him performing.
Yes, well, both of them worked with the Ringling Brothers early in their careers, and they worked with various circuses. And finding the footage, Al was gracious enough to give us some still photographs, but a lot of materials we were able to get from Circus World Museum. That really helped us to really tell the story of the history of it, because it was a long time ago, and when you get to see that archival footage and then you connect that with the current day footage of the parade moving down the streets of Milwaukee, it really tells you what a great piece of history this is and why it's so important to save it.
The footage that you speak of going down Wisconsin Avenue, which pretty much ends the film, it's funny because those of us who've moved here later know that view with the Calatrava Art Museum, and it's not there. In that footage, which is funny. So it means it's earlier than when the Calatrava was built.
Absolutely, that's true. And I remember the first time I saw the parade, I was just stunned. And I thought, how did I not know about this? And I think mostly people only in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or in the surrounding area knew about the parade and even knew it existed. So it's something that I hope people will, you know, get out and see the film and have an appreciation for, you know, how hard Chappie Fox worked to bring these wagons back to life and have them paraded down the streets of Milwaukee.
Does that still happen?
Actually, no. The last parade they did was 2009, and even then they weren't doing it every year. They were only doing it every few years, and it was very expensive. It cost about $2 million to have the parade, and also there was never a corporate sponsor per se where they would brand, you know, this is the, you know, Schlitz Brewing Company parade or anything like that. It was always private donors, and companies would donate the money to have the parade, but they didn't have their names, you know, put on the wagons or anything like that. So that made it a special event as well, because it really was an authentic circus parade.
One of my favorite shots in the latter part of the film is when they're getting the modern day roustabouts are getting the wagons onto the train in Baraboo to get it here.
Exactly. And in the film, one of the gentlemen talks about that some of these guys who show up every year in that summer, and they just want to be a part of the circus, and they actually kind of play circus. They'll take their vacation and time it just so they can be there for the loading of the wagon and also the train ride and also the unloading of the wagon.
I can understand the appeal. It goes back to what everyone kept saying in the film. A lot of different people said it in different ways about the romance of the circus.
Exactly. And I think, you know, especially with the 750 horses that pull the wagons, it's very much a romantic vision. And you see the horses moving in slow motion in the film, and you feel the grandness. And also, you know, it's something that happened hundreds of years ago when the circus would come to town. There weren't motorized vehicles to pull the wagons back then. So seeing the, you know, the horses and the beautiful carved wagons, it really kind of takes you back to a time when things were simpler and there was no internet, there were no cell phones. And I think it's something that we can all appreciate and take a step back and really look at where we're at today and where we used to be. I think that's something that the film offers, is a chance to step back and, you know, sort of it's a little bit of a time capsule.
What about looking forward? I know circuses, there are still some around and people still go. Do they still hold on the imagination? Do people still find them romantic?
Absolutely. I haven't really been to the circus in recent years. So I'm guessing, I think the circuses are still going strong. And I think they've just, one of the strengths of the circuses is that they've been able to change and adapt. And, you know, they still have the trapeze acts and some of the animal acts, but I think they've also, you know, sort of transformed themselves to be able to compete with all the different forms of entertainment that are out there. I mean, now you have, you know, movies and video games and the internet and music. It's just, there's a lot out there for the circuses to compete with. I think they've done a pretty good job. And in some ways, you know, they're still maybe a little bit like these wagons when they used to parade them. They're almost alien, because back in the day, people saw them for the first time and they were alien. And now when you see them today, they're also sort of alien because they're from another time period and another place that most of us aren't familiar with. Maybe our grandparents are, but we aren't. So it's actually a nice way to look at them as sort of a new thing when they come down the street.
Doing this film, has it made you want to go to the circus more?
Absolutely. I mean, the circus, you know, the next time the circus comes to town, maybe I'll get a chance to see it. It's just I haven't had a chance to in recent years. And actually, I now have a 11-month-old son. So I'm sure I'll be going to the circus in the next few years when he's a little bit older.
Well, Gene, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you bringing me on the show.
Gene Gamache is producer and director of the film A Circus Life, which will show tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Oriental Theater. Gamache will lead a Q&A after the screening. He spoke with Bonnie North. There is a link to more information about the film and the Circus World Museum in Baraboo from wuwm.com/lake effect. Milwaukee writer Dean Jensen has had circus history on his mind for a long time. His new book tells the tragic story of two of the circus's early superstars. We'll hear about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we heard from Gene Gamache, producer of a film about the heyday of the American circus and the wagon parades that were part and parcel of the phenomenon. Like any popular form of entertainment, the circus also had its superstars. And in the early 20th century, no stars were brighter than Lillian Leitzel and Alfredo Cadona, who both performed dazzling stunts high in the air, Leitzel from the rings and Cadona from the trapeze. Leitzel and Cadona's lives intersected early, then diverged, but came back together at the apex of their careers and resulted in their marriage. But it was not a happily ever after story. Their story of love and tragedy is the subject of Milwaukee writer Dean Jensen's new book, Queen of the Air. And he's with us in the studio to tell us more. Welcome back to the show.
I'm so happy to be here again.
Help us understand, where was the circus in the public consciousness early in the 20th century?
It was the biggest entertainment and the most democratic entertainment in the early 20s, actually for the first several decades of the 20th century. And it was an entertainment also that crosshatched the entire country. There were, at that period in history, more than 100 circuses. Now, some of them were just tiny affairs of a few horse-drawn wagons. And then there were circuses of great size that traveled in trains with more than 100 cars, half the animals that might be found at the Bronx Zoo. It was an opportunity for people back then to a rural audience to see things that otherwise hadn't been available to them.
Well, and the stars of the circus, what would their equivalent be today?
Their equivalent would be the huge rock stars of the day, you know, the Beyoncés and the Madonnas. I don't know if Madonna is any longer a huge rock star, but Lietzel herself, the heroine of my book, was really a diva. Her name was known everywhere. Her full name was Lillian Lietzel, but everybody just referred to her as Lietzel.
Much like Madonna or Beyonce.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Would you say, did her public appeal lie more in her glamour or her athleticism, or can you separate the two?
I don't think you can separate the two. She was almost fairy-like in the first place. She was just 4'9", weighed 94 pounds. So she was this tiny little woman, but she did amazing things in the big top stratosphere. Her signature performance was when she would do flanges, or these are throwovers in which she'd be dangling from the Roman ring in the sky of the big top, do these throwovers of her body, heels overhead, in which she actually dislocated her arm from her shoulder with each of these revolutions. And it was grueling. It was almost painful to watch.
And she would do dozens of these.
She would do sometimes as many, typically would do 100 in a performance. It would be 90 or 110. And while she was doing these, the crowd would be tolling off the numbers, 20, 21, 22. And at the same time, the drummers in the band would be tolling off her throwovers. They would become so fast, they would start out slow, and then they would keep, as her momentum gathered, they would get faster and faster. And she would be suddenly just kind of a blur in the near the ceiling of the big top.
By the end of her time in the circus, she had been doing this for years.
She had started really when she was 8 years old, and she was 39 when she fell to her death. She fell to her death on a Friday the 13th in February. In fiction, would never be as preposterous to suggest that this happened on a Friday the 13th, but in fact, is when she fell to her death. And she fell not because of she slipped off the Roman rings, but rather the Roman rings, which were attached to a hanging rope by a metal fixture. That fixture crystallized, and then she plunged to her death.
Not only was it Friday the 13th, if I'm not mistaken, she was also 13th on the billing
on the
day.
Program. Yeah, this book is always, in writing it, almost seemed as though there were gods involved, and the circus people are very suspicious. So they think their world is determined really by happiness of the of the gods and fates.
Well, and the other character, you know, if she was the queen of the circus, the character that is also at the heart of this book never seems like he quite became the king, but he was certainly royalty. Tell us about where Alfredo Cadona started. He had pretty humble origins, if you will.
He did indeed. His father had a family circus in Mexico that never had great success. It traveled in a single railroad car, a baggage car. He would rent space and then move through Mexico, primarily played little desert towns. And the circus at first was largely made up of just his father, Eduardo, and his mother, Hortense. And then some children came along, among them Alfredo, and they became part of the circus. But yes, his origins were humble ones. And in fact, it was his sister, Victoria, who was a slackwire walker, who first gained wider attention. She was hired by the Barnum and Bailey Circus in America, and Alfredo, this young trapeze flyer, her brother, just was kind of thrown in on the deal. But he became the greatest flyer of all time. He was known for what is called in the circus the triple. This is a feat that has probably taken more circus daredevils than any other. And what one did in the triple is you would leave the swinging bar of the trapeze and then throw three somersaults in the air while traveling at 60 miles an hour and then dock up with the catcher at the other end of the trapeze rigging. It took him 10 years to perfect that feat, but then he became known as sort of the Nijinsky of the flying trapeze. He was just a graceful flyer.
Well, and if it weren't tragedy enough that Lietzel fell to her death from the trapeze, there was plenty of tragedy in the love affair between Lietzel and Alfredo. They both had marriages that came and went leading up to their marriage to each other. In fact, Alfredo's marriage ended because he reconnected with Lietzel, who he had always been in love with.
Yes.
It was not, I guess from your description, given their history and past relationships, Lietzel and Alfredo seemed like they were the wrong people to be married to each other. What were their expectations for this marriage?
Their marriage at times was just passionate. They were absolutely mad for one another, but at other times it became very tempestuous. Even though Lietzel, with some misgivings, had married Alfredo, and this was partly brought on by the management, she would continue to see other men. And, of course, Alfredo was, you know, jealous at these dalliances she had with other men. So that was a source of a lot of difficulty in that marriage. But as I said, it was, to some degree, was brought on by the management, because Lietzel was such an adored figure that the circus would arrange assignations between Lietzel and judges and mayors and others in the other world that the circus thought might be helpful to the circus. This, as I said, was a source of just constant irritation in that marriage, as it would be in any marriage, I should guess.
Well, and of course, at the same time, Lietzel had insisted that that Alfredo get rid of his ex-wife as part of the act and replace her with someone else. The someone else ended up being involved with Alfredo, and they ended up marrying after Lietzel's death.
Yeah. Lietzel was troubled by the fact that even though Alfredo and his first wife, Clara Curtin, a flyer in his act, had divorced, he had retained her in his flying act. There were three in the act. There was Alfredo and Clara Curtin, and then Lalo Cadona, who was the catcher in the act. So Lietzel was bothered by the fact that Alfredo continued Clara's employment in the act, and she finally persuaded him to shelve that earlier wife. And then, at Lietzel's suggestion, Alfredo hired another young woman on the circus, Vera Bruce, who in fact had been an apprentice of Lietzel, a very attractive woman. That was probably not a good case of judgment on Lietzel's part, because then Alfredo became attracted to Vera in a romantic way, and thus the Alfredo and Lietzel marriage started fraying.
And inevitably, after Lietzel's death, the Alfredo and Vera marriage,
yes,
frayed as well, and ended in the ultimate tragedy of this book.
That is the ultimate tragedy in the book. They both came to very violent ends. They divorced or were very nearly divorced. Alfredo then took Vera's life and then his own. You know, look at the arc of this book. It's almost like a modern Greek tragedy, I think, because in tragedy, by definition, at least in a literary definition, the players put their own ends into motion. And I think this happened in this instance as well, because of the foibles of the characters in the book. They all put their own ends, which were violent, into motion.
If I'm not mistaken, this story has been part of your life for three decades, at
least? Yes. Yes, it's a curious thing. I'd written a book that came out, I think, around 1980. It was my first book. And it was a history, a circus history. And following its publication, I received a call from Alfred Pelikan, who had been the he was retired at the time, but he had been the director of the Old Milwaukee Art Institute, a predecessor to the Milwaukee Art Museum. And I had known Alfred in that context because as a newspaper man, I would call him now and then for some history about the art scene in Milwaukee in the 20s or teens. Alfred called me to his home one day for lunch, and we had a nice spirited discussion about art. And then he said he wanted to show me something. He led me elsewhere in the house to his study, opened the door, then switched on the light, and my skin turned to goose flesh immediately. And as I say now, I think I could almost hear the blood splashing in my veins, because on the wall were these photographs and circus posters of Lillian Leitzel, who I recognized immediately from the images. She was the most famous performer in the circus's history, which was then over two centuries. And Alfred whispered to me, he said, Leitzel was my sister. And I looked at him. I was stupefied. And he then said to me that if you ever want to do something on my sister's story, this is yours to work with. So he had all of these photographs, all of these posters, and he had also in that room rubber banded these bundles of correspondence from his sister from probably 30 years from all parts of the world. And that was what launched the project.
Well, it certainly opens a window to the world that most of us never had. And Dean Jensen, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
I much enjoyed it. Thank you.
Dean Jensen is author of the new book, Queen of the Air, A True Story of Love and Tragedy at the Circus, published by Crown. Jensen, who owns the Dean Jensen Gallery and is former arts critic for the Milwaukee Sentinel, will talk about the book Thursday evening at Boswell Book Company. That's Monday's edition of Lake Effect. Our Project Milwaukee Power Switch series continues tomorrow with a look at how sustainability is faring on a state level in Wisconsin and across the country. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.